Well, wherever you're driving, listening to Coast right now, I hope you keep your hands 10 and 2, according to what I'm seeing on both the net and on the networks. It's a little tricky out there. Our storm has passed largely here in the upper Midwest, and although the roads are pretty slushy and temperatures are about 5 below 0 right now, not including the wind chill factor, it's fairly doable on the roads. Not true about 5 hours ago. I think we got about maybe 5 inches of snow or something like that in the last 36 hours. But we're still getting a little bit more as these temperatures drop ahead. And all the way out to the East Coast and then back out to the West on the other side of the Midwest there, everybody's getting something. All except for the Deep South, Texas, Florida, those places aren't getting anything this time, although they already have. Harry Shearer, with whom we spoke yesterday on Coast to Coast, he showed me a photograph of his, taken outside of his home in New Orleans, and it was the streets of New Orleans covered in snow from just a couple of days ago. So I guess everybody's getting it a little bit. It would only be appropriate here on the first day of winter. It's already the 21st in a large part of the United States, and that means it's the Yule celebration, the winter solstice, true both for people who are Wicca, which are celebrating the Yule in its original form, those people who are Christian that absorb Yule as part of the celebration of Christmas. I think, isn't this traditionally the beginning of the 12 days of Christmas? And then sundown on the 21st will be Hanukkah, the beginning of the observance in Judaism. So a busy time for the holidays. Christmas is on the way. A lot of people are going to be getting gift cards. Many of those gift cards will be for bookstores. And so, boy, do we have two great ones for you tonight. We'll start first with Shadow Divers, the true adventure of two Americans who risked everything to solve one of the last mysteries of World War II. I wanted so much to get more time with Richie Kohler, who's one of those two Americans who risked everything to solve one of the last mysteries of World War II. But we got an hour. So to make the most of it, I'm ditching crypto news and reading any email or anything like that, and I'm skipping right ahead to Richie Kohler standing by next. Then next hour, we'll learn how we can change the world, plus how to make money while you're doing it. A futurist in his own right, a guy who has been studying creative trends for a while, taking a look into 2009, Guy Kawasaki. The book is Reality Check, and we'll talk about both the future technology, how does a great idea come together, where is the magic for a world-changing idea, and where are the world changers right now as we speak? People who may not know that they are one could be listening tonight to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, we tripped onto an interview tonight with Richie Kohler a couple of weeks ago. So glad we did. Good evening, Richie.
Evening, Ian. How are you?
Good. Again, thank you for giving us the time that you are. This book is great. I know you have many more projects that you're involved with. And to focus even on Shadow Divers, I still won't be able to give it enough time tonight for my taste, because I just find this work so interesting. The depths of the dive, as a great metaphor for the depths of the writing. Very well done by Robert Kersen.
Yeah, Robert really did all the heavy lifting. My partner John Chatterton and I really were very fortunate that he came to us with an interest to tell our story.
Well, the book to me is reminiscent of The Perfect Storm.
I've heard that comparison, as well as Into Thin Air.
Oh, yeah. Right,
basically,
exactly.
Man against nature. It's written in the same genre, but obviously decidedly different in many respects. And that there's a historic aspect to this as well.
Well, and I think the Into Thin Air comparison is a good one too, about the famous sort of doomed climb on Mount Everest for many reasons. In particular, though, it's just how much it reveals about the art and the science of what you do, not just the object of your pursuit. That you really feel like it's almost like reading Melville or something, and you feel like you understand whaling after reading Moby Dick.
Well, you know, I'm going to have a lot of trouble having Robert Kirsten put his hat on after you make a comparison to Melville.
Okay? It's pretty cool, though. It's pretty cool. Well, and that makes you a figure not unlike, honestly, I mean, especially for the fact that you survived this, that puts you in the category of Ishmael in Moby Dick, in that this was not an easy dive to survive this German U-boat, which we'll get to coming up in just a second. But let me give a little bit of background for you. You've been doing these technical and wreck dives since, what, roughly 1980?
But basically, I got my start in diving in the mid-70s. And by the early 1980s, had elevated to what we now call technical diving, but it was really deep air diving way deeper than the sport diving limit of about 130 feet. We were doing dives regularly to 200 feet using air, and anybody who's got any background in diving knows that you can't just simply breathe air deeper than 150 feet without having a myriad of problems,
right? Temporary insanity being one of them.
Some of us go into the water in that state, but yes, there's something that's been referred to by Jacques Cousteau as rapture of the depths, and other people have applied a rule of thumb called Martini's Law, which basically right. states that if you go down approximately 230 feet, let's say, it's the equivalent of drinking 5 martinis on an empty stomach. That is the effect that nitrogen has when you breathe compressed gas or air at depth. So being able to handle this narcosis, this inebriation, if you will, is something that's a learned behavior. In a way, we become good drunks.
And, right.
So having a penchant for drinking before, you know, before you ever take up deep diving could probably help you if you're going to use air.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like drunk diving, right?
Yeah, it's, in a way. Yeah. But believe it or not.
But in a controlled environment. But, yeah, I can see it. In fact, I like how Robert Kirsten refers to it here, that going to such depths, he said the diver must know the creases and folds of dread. In your own brain, you have to be able to sort of, you end up, as the deeper you go, the more demons you have to face of your own creation. You're not meeting monsters of the deep, you're meeting monsters of your deep internal self.
You know, the funny thing about narcosis is that if you're diving in the Bahamas and the water is clear and warm, you dive to 200 feet, it'll be a euphoric experience. You may, as again, to quote Jacques Cousteau, want to take out your regulator and pass it to a fish as he goes by. But if you take that same depth and put it here in the North Atlantic, off the coast of New Jersey, per se, where it's cold and dark, ominous, turbid water that you can't see very far, all of a sudden, these demons, these monsters, seem to come out of the dark. And even the most minor thing, like a fishing line getting caught on your equipment, all of a sudden becomes a problem that weighs heavily and increases your risk for panic and right. making a bad move.
Well, that's definitely some of the shadows of shadow divers. Again, we're talking with Richie Kohler, who's the subject of the book. And we'll get to the core of it in a minute, but let's just use this then as a metaphor that a lot of the book sets up, that diving at the depths that we're going to be talking about here, it's a little bit like working in an underwater funhouse or an underwater haunted house at an amusement park or something, because a lot of things are going to pop up, and how you react to them may make the difference between never coming back up again from that dive and living to be in a book like this.
Well, you know, most of the guys that most of the people, I should say, because it's not a totally male-dominated sport, that do this type of diving build to it. They start in the shallows, if you will, 60, 70 foot of water, and even if it may be here in the Northeast where it's dark, those are the wrecks we approach with training wheels, if you will. No one in their right mind is going to go to 200, 300 feet of water and then start going inside a ship and expect to get out if you haven't put in the time, if you haven't paid your dues in the shallows first. You have to train. You have to be prepared for this. The dangers that await you are many. I mean, obviously, operating with scuba tanks running out of gas is probably the number one. You have a finite amount of air. If you panic, if you become trapped, if you become disoriented and lost, you may not get out in time to be able to make it to the surface. You may use all that gas. Factored into that is, of course, the narcosis, which can, of course, exacerbate the situation.
Right.
And then there's the simple problem of decompression, which is that as we go down deep and stay for a long period of time, we can no longer simply just come back up to the surface. We have to do it in stages. We have to come up and stop at a pre-described depth for a predetermined amount of time to
sure.
off-gas the nitrogen that's built up in our blood.
Right,
if
right.
you don't do this, it's just exactly like taking a bottle of soda pop, shaking it up, and then releasing the top. The bubbles that were in solution, once we release the top, now come out. The same thing would happen in your blood.
Right.
So, all this is lined up against you as you jump in the boat and pull yourself down the anchor line.
So let's jump ahead a little bit then in the story, the true story of Shadow Divers. How did you first hear about this mysterious wreck off the coast of New Jersey, this submarine, this German submarine? How did you first get involved in this?
Well, you know, there's a relatively small, at least in the late 80s, there was a relatively small community of wreck divers, hardcore wreck divers, that were not the weekend holiday makers. I don't want you to be thinking of some people that go to the Virgin Islands and, you know, have a drink with a piece of fruit hanging out of it, and they dive for an hour in the sunshine and then come back up and lounge about the pool. The diving that we're talking about here off the east coast of the United States, and wrecks in particular, is real hardcore exploration. The water, again, is deep, relatively 200 feet was the norm at that point to be looking for new shipwrecks. To get that depth of water, you had to go at least 30 to 40 miles offshore, so it necessitated a long boat ride. And the water is incredibly cold, so a dry suit, a way of keeping yourself thermally protected, as well as double tanks, makes you look like an aquanaut, if you will, more of an astronaut than what you would probably think of the weekend scuba diver. These people would go out, I won't say every weekend, but as often as they could, and look for new shipwrecks. Some people would say that by the late 80s, all the good wrecks had been found and that there really wasn't any other mysteries out there to be found. And when Bill Nagel, in September of 1992, stumbled on what he thought was the remains of a World War II German U-boat, they tried to keep this secret. They realized that if this really was a German U-boat, that this would be something significant, and they tried to keep it secret and so that other divers wouldn't jump their claim. And I was one of the divers they tried to keep this secret from. But fortunately for me, a member of that original dive team called me up in the middle of the night and harassed me, much like you, about this time of night. I get a phone call from a guy who says, "Hey, Richie, we found something fantastic, but I've swore on my honor that I can't tell you. You're going to have to guess."
So, oh, come on.
No, exactly. And of course, there was much profanity and cursing. And he would not tell me. And finally, I, after about a half hour going back and forth, he gave me a clue where he said, in a very heavy, fake Italian accent, "It's not a mud boat." And I'm going, "What kind of clue is that? What are you talking about?" I'm mentioning ships that had been lost off the Jersey coast that hadn't been found yet. It was none of them. And then finally, after about the fourth or fifth time that he said, "It's not on my boat," I said, "It's not on my boat. It's a U-boat." And that, it just clicked. I'm like, "What are you, crazy?"
I love that.
No, truth is stranger than fiction, but that's the way
great.
It went down. And one thing leads to another. I'm like, there is no German U-boat in the history books recorded as being sunk off the coast of New Jersey. It can't possibly be. And so that midnight phone call was my first indication that there was the possibility of a German U-boat being lost off the coast. Now, there was a couple of problems. The first was that, obviously, the boat crew wanted to keep it secret. The second was that one of the principal members of that crew a guy named John Chatterton, and I were enemies, to say the least. So the possibility of me getting on that trip was highly unlikely just for that fact.
Now, you say enemies. You guys have been doing the show together for a long time on the History Channel, so tell me about being enemies with John Chatterton.
Well, you got to realize that the History Channel show and all the subsequent work, and of course, we're great friends now and business partners, but back in 1992, I was a member of the Atlantic Wreck Divers, a group of divers based out of New York, and John Chatterton was a member of the dive team on board the Seeker, which was based out of New Jersey. And in some circles, you know, him being from New Jersey, me being from New York, was enough not to like each other.
Exactly. Oh, no, I know. Precisely. So you, at some point, he agreed then, or did there was a vote, or did you buy in? How do you get in?
Well, what happened was, unfortunately, a tragedy on what would be the third trip to the U-boat, that there would be a fatality. A gentleman named Steve Feldman succumbed to what we believe is a deep water blackout. We'll never know because his body was swept away by the currents, and although it was recovered months later, we'll really never know what exactly happened. It appears that he simply went to sleep at depth, and that is indicative of what they call deep water blackout, which is a problem that can happen when you're diving deep and breathing air. And that fatality, that death, obviously affected all the people that were of the original group. Many of them decided not to go back, and the boat captain, Bill Nagel, and John Chatterton, as well as a few others, realized that, you know, if this really was a U-boat, it was a significant historical find, and they didn't want to give up, but they needed to have other people to come out to help offset the great cost. I mean, the wreck was located 60 miles offshore. The boat fuel had to be paid for. So basically, with the fatality, the news was out that these guys had located some kind of a significant submarine wreck, and that other divers could come along. Well, my friend, the fellow who called me up in the middle of the night, a gentleman named Kevin Brennan, put my name in the pot, and I had been diving on the Seeker in the past, and the boat captain, Bill Nagel, knew me quite well, knew I was able to handle myself in that kind of depth of water. But he also recognized that I had a personal feud with his partner, John Chatterton. But he decided to intercede on my behalf and told John that whether John liked it or not, Richie Kohler could come on the trip. So, you know, pretty much with me sticking my tongue out of Chatterton, I loaded my gear on the boat, thinking it's only going to take me one dive, you know, to go down there and figure out what this was.
Well, so you start to do the dives. How long did it take you to find out what was on the bottom of the ocean?
Well, to be honest with you, it only took one dive for me to realize there was a big rusty steel wreck. To be honest, the identity of that submarine wreck would ultimately take us 6 years. And because the diving was so difficult, because the distance offshore and the conditions in the North Atlantic so challenging, our dives were limited. The wreck would continue to exact a terrible price when, over the course of 6 years, two more of our friends and divers would die diving the wreck. There was many twists and turns, which we'll cover over the next hour, but the reality is that this was a bona fide enigma. Quite simply, when we dove that day, the trip that I was on, there was a point where only John Chatterton and I were in the water. The afternoon weather had picked up, and not many people opted to make a second dive that day, only myself and John Chatterton. And John had recovered some objects that he had in a net bag, like a mesh bag that he had affixed to his belt. And as we were sending up the anchor line to do those decompression stops, I could see him above me. And I could see in that bag that he had some artifacts which appeared to be porcelain, like crockery. As I came up, he recognized me by my equipment configuration and my trademark red suit, and he pulled the bag away. He didn't want me to look inside it.
Well, hang on. We'll pick up right there then. Just as they're breaking water again, and then how do they end up being partners? And what did we find, and what is it that explains how this German U-boat both ended up so close to the coast of the United States off the shores of New Jersey, but also how did it go undetected? Why was it unknown to be there? The true adventure of two Americans who risked everything to solve one of the last mysteries of World War II coming up. Shadow Divers continues with Richie Kohler, who's the subject of the book by Robert Kersen. What a terrific read. More on that, and then also the future of technology, of the great ideas, where the magic happens, how it's happened in the past, and how you can get involved coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Our first hour is Richie Kohler, who's the subject of the book Shadow Divers. Terrific read. Looking forward to savoring this book over Christmas vacation and a couple of cigars or a pipe or two on my porch. And if you're driving somewhere and the snow is blowing like it is here in the upper Midwest, or if you're experiencing ice or a power outage somewhere, what better subject to take your mind off the darkness in which you sit or the cold which you're fighting than to think about being somewhere in a wetsuit, going deep under the ocean, looking for something dark and deep and mysterious like this sub, this wreck of U-869. But they didn't know it was German sub U-869 right away. And Richie Kohler gets back to explaining how they were able to determine that and what was it doing there. How close did this sub come to our shore, and why? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Richie Kohler, since you have been doing wreck dives since roughly around 1980, how many people have you known who have died or been killed during a deep sea dive?
Well, unfortunately, more than I'd like to admit, I've been personal witness to five diving fatalities in that period of time, and gosh, I've probably heard about at least a dozen more. Yeah. Without straining the imagination. So
that's a lot of people for what is still essentially a small community of highly qualified divers.
It is growing. The technology and books like Shadow Divers have made sport divers really want to push the envelope. I mean, quite literally, history is waiting for us off our beaches. It is waiting for us in the lakes and rivers. And scuba is a way for people to visit that history, to correct it, much like we did in the story Shadow Divers.
Well, let's correct that then. So as you were eventually brought in on this very dangerous dive to a find of a World War II German submarine, you said you started the process to determine the name of the sub and why it was there. Talk about that.
Well, the first thing that we wanted to do was confirm. It was an assumption on behalf of the divers that it was even a German U-boat, and this was based loosely on the way that it was shaped. I mean, and having been diving other World War II era shipwrecks, we could look at the deterioration and the amount of incrustation outside and gauge its age by that. But nothing up until the third trip had been located on the wreck to indicate its nationality. And before we went to the break, I was telling you that I was diving with John Chatterton, who was my enemy at the time. We didn't even like each other. And he had recovered some objects, and I had rose up through the water column to look in his bag. He pulls it away from me, won't let me look. Finally, he must have seen in my eyes that I meant no harm. I wasn't going to stab him with my knife and take his bag away. And he released his grip on it, and it could get into my hands. I could spin the bag around, and I could look into the mesh bag and see that he recovered a series of bowls and plates. And on the back of one of them was the eagle and swastika and the year 1942.
How about that?
And the recovery of that bit of crockery proved that this shipwreck was indeed a World War II-era German U-boat. When we got back to the dock that night, we thought that it would be a simple matter, first of going back to our history books, that somewhere in our history books, it had to be written down that there was a German U-boat attacked and sunk off the coast of Point Pleasant, that somehow, you know, we missed that. When we found out that there was no record of that, we then went to first the American government and then to the German government and then found out that there had been no German U-boat lost, that somehow this U-boat and its crew, because subsequent dives would reveal that the crew was still aboard, had some way, somehow slipped through the cracks and was lying unknown and anonymous just 60 miles off, you know, the coast of New Jersey.
So how can you, if you have no frame of reference, how can you start to determine how it got there or how it got off the coast of New Jersey, for that matter, and then how did it end up on the ocean bottom?
Well, that's an excellent question. And in a way, it's the work that we did over 6 years that ultimately got us a job for the History Channel as deep sea detectives. But we really cut our teeth on this. The first thing that we had to do was, once we liaised with the experts, both in Germany and the United States, we came to the conclusion that during World War II, there was about 60 German U-boats that were lost on patrol, cause unknown. Simply put, these boats sailed out for war patrol, and then nothing was ever heard from them again. They sailed into oblivion. We thought that this submarine must be one of those. This is a submarine that was originally ordered to operate most likely off the coast of the United States and simply never came home. They don't know what happened. The first thing that we needed to do was try and find objects on the wreck that would help us identify it. But warships, especially late war German U-boats, weren't exactly well built. It's not like they had a bell with the name on them. This boat, having been on the bottom of the seafloor for 60 years, was in no condition to simply go up and rub the silt off the side and read the name, even if they had done that. But because it was a wartime boat, they didn't have the number on the side. So we had to go inside. And let me tell you something, diving 230 feet and then crawling inside a broken submarine that's filled with debris, silt, the twisted remains of all the plumbing and wiring splayed out and open. Oh, yeah, and there's 56 dead human beings strewn about the compartment as well. This really amps up the adrenaline.
Sure.
You also only have a very small, finite amount of gas in your tanks, roughly enough for about a 20-minute bottom time. You can only do 20 to 25 minutes, and then you've got to turn around and come up and do about a 1.5-hour decompression. If you spend more than 25 minutes on the bottom, you'll probably use all your gas, run out of air, and drown. All this in the back of your mind, you're searching these compartments of a World War II submarine, quite literally trying not to disturb the human remains, and do this in such a way so that you can still get out of the submarine without stirring the visibility.
Can you tell me about the condition of the bodies?
One of the things that obviously most people ask this question, and I have to tell you that when I first dove this German U-boat, I had been diving many shipwrecks that had loss of life. One of them you may know of, the Andrea Doria passenger liner, sunk in 1956 with over 50 people killed. Now, we knew that there were people lost on the on the Andrea Doria, but you never see the human remains. The sea absorbs them. Not so inside this German U-boat. Now, before you start envisioning, you know, the body's still there, no, the flesh is gone, but the skeletal remains still are there, in some cases still in their uniforms where they fell in the compartment.
I'll be darned.
Half buried in the silt. And you know, early on, my partner John Chatterton and I, even though at the very beginning we didn't agree on many things, we did agree on one thing, and that was that in no way, shape, or form should we disturb these human remains.
Right,
you
right.
Know, for different reasons, we had the same goal. We wanted to identify the submarine, and we didn't want to do it in a less than perfect way. For me, over the few years that it took us to solve this, I kind of connected with my German heritage, and I knew that one day I wanted to knock on someone's door and tell them not what they knew. They knew that their loved ones didn't come home at the end of the war. What I wanted to tell them was that they had been found, that they no longer lay anonymous on the bottom of the ocean, and that the people that found them treated them with respect. And that was important to us. So operating in the submarine, kind of literally with kids' gloves, we knew that the answer in some way could possibly be in the pocket of one of these fallen sailors, yet we chose not to rifle through their pockets and instead looked for other ways to identify the submarine.
How long did it take you to find U-869?
You know, it was 6 years. 6 long years, and in that time we would find things that would give us a clue. The first thing that we needed to do was try to narrow down the type of submarine it was, whether it was a Type 7, a Type 21, a Type 9. Once we figured out what type of submarine it was, type of German U-boat, we could then look at the records and say, well, how many of these particular type were ever ordered to the United States, and how many of those were never accounted for. So eventually, after a few years, we were actually able to whittle it down to 3 possibilities, only 3. And though all 3 of them were built in the same yard, all 3 of them left from Germany roughly within a few weeks of each other, and all 3 of them were lost within a few months of each other during the war. So they were identically built, lost at roughly the same time, and it was an incredibly difficult task. We needed to be 100% certain. And the only way to do that was to get something from the wreck with the identity of the submarine, quite literally something with the name, or in this case, the number of what ship it was.
So any way you, in researching the name, started to come across the mission? I mean, were those 2 things tied together? You said 3 were launched at the same time. Was there a consistency to what happened to the other 2 subs that were launched at that time? And were they, was it, did you get a picture already that there were a lot more German submarines trolling up and down the eastern seaboard than people realized?
You know, Ian, when we started this out, we were expert wreck divers, but we knew very little about the Battle of the Atlantic, as the U-boat wars were called during World War II. Interesting enough that the U-boat war, the Battle of the Atlantic, was the longest-running campaign. It actually started in 1938, and it didn't end until Germany capitulated. The German U-boats were out there fighting the entire time. And so we had to contend with that, the fact that, you know, for not only the American involvement, but entire world war, that these U-boats were sailing the oceans. One of the things that we found out early on is that, you know, history is a work in progress, and that what we thought was perfect, the history that we read in books, all of a sudden we realized how truly flawed it is. Not only flawed because of perspective, but flawed because, you know, at the end of the war, so many of the boats and so much of the history was written down in a hurry, so to speak, to get on with life. And in a way, that's what happened to this boat. This boat was actually assigned a different fate. Now, I don't want to get into too much. I'm hoping that there are some of our listeners out there that have not read this story. And although we've mentioned the identity, I really think this is a world-class mystery. We worked very hard on it. Rob Kirsten did a fantastic job telling our story. And for those people, it would be interesting for them to enjoy the sleuthing that we had to do. I mean, again, we didn't come into this with any experience. We had to learn as we go.
Right.
And at terrible cost. As I mentioned, we did lose not one, but 3 divers trying to solve this.
Ordinarily, I would object to that, and I would say, You know, the they're going to buy the book anyway because this is such a great story that this and we they people recognize this as being a great gift as well. But I have to say, it is it would be from what and I haven't finished it yet, but it would be a little bit like giving away the ending of Citizen Kane or something like that. So I'll go along with that to a point, but help me out to just a little bit of degree, just to give some closure to the people who are listening. What do you in the end learn about the number of U-boats that were in this kind of proximity, and how close do you think U-869 got to, you know, to a place where they could have floated some German sailors in a raft up onto the Jersey shore at Point Pleasant?
Well, a couple of things that I did learn during this entire research trying to identify the submarine was you're not far off at all. As a matter of fact, there was two landings on American shores and one in Canadian where German U-boats actually did land saboteurs on American and Canadian soil. German U-boats operated almost with impunity for the first few years of the war in American waters. As a matter of fact, they referred to it, the German U-boat commanders called it the Great American Turkey Shoot, because we were so woefully unprepared for the German U-boats as they came over here. It was a slaughter, if you will, of right. American merchant shipping. And one of the things that the German U-boats were specifically trying to target was our tankers, because obviously aviation fuel and fuel itself was basically needed for the war effort. So
this is in the era of the Lend-Lease program at the very beginning, right, where we were sending over material to England.
Exactly. And then, of course, once Pearl Harbor happened and then we were drawn into the war, now everything that floated off the coast of the United States was fair game. And, I mean, when you think about it, the first operation, which was called Pockenschlag, there was only 6 boats allocated to attack American shipping. And in the first week, they sank 25 American ships, ultimately thousands of ships. Thousands of ships would be sunk by German U-boats off the coast of the United States. Some of them, quite literally, within sight of the beaches. To that end, at the during the course of the war, about a half a dozen of these German U-boats ultimately would be sunk by Allied anti-submarine forces. And we didn't know if this U-boat was one of them that somehow slipped through the cracks. We did not have an accounting. So two regular guys, I mean, John Chatterton was a commercial diver. I fixed windows. That's what I did for a living. on the weekend would go out and try to figure this out. So, you know, by day I would be at a Kentucky Fried Chicken fixing the window, and then that weekend I would be crawling, you know, into a 60-year-old sea mystery, apologizing to the fallen sailors for disturbing them,
right.
and in some ways asking for their help to figure out who they really were.
Going to be a movie here coming up, I hear.
You know, we're keeping our fingers crossed. The folks at 20th Century Fox have picked up the rights. I'm hearing all kinds of great stuff. They've got a couple of wonderful people lined up for directors.
I'm hearing Peter Weir.
Peter Weir was definitely one of the early people in. Right now, it's Tony Scott.
Oh, really?
Yep.
That would be really good.
Exactly. Peter Weir chewed it up. We had a screenplay written by Bill Broyles that they were chewing on. And again, it's, you know, like history, it's a work in progress. These guys,
sure.
You know, they're obviously a lot smarter than John and I. So we are keeping our fingers crossed that they'll make this movie. And, you know, how wacky is that?
Well, I think it's going to be great. Obviously, it's a terrific read. Again, we're talking about the book Shadow Divers by Robert Kersen. Richie Kohler is one of the two main people in it. What are you working on right now? Can you tell us?
Oh, no, absolutely. One of the other things that we have going out, it's a shameless plug for the second book, is Titanic's Last Secrets. I mean, once we solved the mystery of this German U-boat, John and I were... It changed our lives. Gave us an opportunity to be on a documentary. That documentary turned into an opportunity to work for the History Channel on a series. We produced 57 episodes of a program called Deep Sea Detectives. At the same time as we're working for television, Robert Kurson wrote the book Shadow Divers. John and I had an opportunity to go with arguably the greatest shipwreck in the world. We actually chartered the research vessel Keldysh and went out and dove Titanic. We didn't go out there simply with the idea of doing yet another documentary. We had received a clue that we could get out there and possibly change what people thought about how Titanic sank. And somehow, some way, we pulled that off.
Well, I love that, and that's a conversation we've had on Coast to Coast. So thank you, Richie Kohler, for circling back with us so we could find out more about Shadow Divers. And I know the book is not a new book, but it reads like a Tom Clancy novel. I mean, it's terrific. People ought to pick it up. And every diver I know has read the book. In fact, every diver I spoke with in the last couple of weeks talked about it like I might as well have been talking about the Bible. Like, of course I've read that one. So we'll cut off the conversation for now, Richie Kohler, and we'd love to get you back again sometime and talk about whatever project you're working on next. And thank you so much for the time you gave us. And God bless you. And Merry Christmas. And Happy Hanukkah to everybody, too. And we'll come back then. Where are the next big ideas coming from? What is the magic behind that creativity? How does it all work in our heads? Next on Coast to Coast.